Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. It's Friday, February 3rd in the afternoon. We have a lot of people signed up, but there are the first four bills. We don't have fiscals on them, so I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1503. And again, there was no one signed up to testify, and so we will be moving this to Monday for the work session. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1503. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1504. Again, we don't have the fiscal, and there was no one to sign up on this bill, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1504, and we will move that one to Monday.
Work session.
Pardon?
The work session.
The work session to Monday. Then I'll close. Did I close it? Close the public hearing on 1504. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1507. Again, we have some amendments that are going to be proposed. They were technical, we'll just carry this bill over to Monday, and I'll close the public hearing on 1507. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1565. Again, we don't have the fiscal on this bill, and we will have, but there was no one to testify on it. There's evidently no opposition, so I will. We will have a work session on
Monday.
A work session on 1565 on Monday. I'll close a public hearing on Senate Bill 1565, and then open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1580. Colleagues, we have how many pages? We have three pages of testimony on Senate Bill 1580, so I would like you to keep your comments concise and to the point, and if someone else happened to state what you had, say, yes, I agree totally with what they say, and move on. So, who's first?
Well, I'm not sure where you want to start.
Okay. I don't believe the health authority was going to testify. This is primarily for everybody else. And so, okay. First of all, is there anyone here that lives more than 100 miles?
I do.
Yeah, I know.
Not all of these people.
Yeah, that was a question, right?
Your jokes are always funnier when you're a legislator, aren't they?
County, anyone from Central Oregon? Okay. All right, then it doesn't. And I know that one did, but I know he doesn't live more than 100 miles. Okay. All right. With that, which one was the first one?
I'm going to vote to I'm going to vote him seriously.
So I'd like to call Jackie Mercer from the Native American Rehabilitation Association.
Is he with him?
Yes. Holden Lung and the Asian Health and Family Center. Holden Lung from the Asian Health and Family Center. Are they here? Okay.
We've got to get into the ways and means we can work to do that. You guys do what you have to do.
Proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and Committee Member. My name is Holden Leung, Executive Director of the Asian Health and Service Center. And I'm coming here serving as the co-chair of the Alliance of Culturally Specific Behavioral Health Providers and Programs. And before I do the testimony, I would like to also introduce my core members who are also present today. So sitting next to me is co-chair Jackie Mercer. We also have Sonia Irwin from Central City Concern, Daniel Garcia from Central City Concern, Sefford Millers from Lutheran Family Services, and Chris Wiley from International Psychiatric Program of OHSU. We also have our consultant, Ava Gottlieb, with us, and also my colleague, Christine Lau from the Asian Health and Service Center.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So I think this is a very good opportunity for us to have this opportunity to introduce the Alliance. From now on, I will use the Alliance rather than the full name of the Alliance of Culturally Specific Behavioral Health Providers. We are coming here not just to introduce the Alliance, but we are actually coming here to offer our solutions to for help. The Alliance actually is a group collectively has more than 100 years of infrastructure, clinical expertise in serving the racial and ethnic populations in Oregon. So we come here, want to introduce ourselves to the Senate committee member. At the same time, we have our solutions, but we need your support. There's to employ community assets to address community challenge. We would like to mandate Oregon Health Authorities and CCOs integrating the cultural specific behavioral health providers and programs into plans for the Oregon's healthcare transformations to provide a continuum of care to the racial and ethnic population, closer linkage to primary care and reduce health inequity. So maybe I would like to spend a minute to introduce our constituents. This alliance serves consumers from African Americans, Asians, Hispanic, Native Americans, immigrants and refugees from Eastern Europe, Africa, Middle Eastern country. So with this diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds, we cannot easily understand when they suffer from severe mental illness, the situation becomes even more complex. A lot of them gone through a lot of torture back in their homeland, and due to language barrier, cultural differences, it's very difficult to engage them into the care model that we currently have. So the provider having over 100 years of clinical experience serving in the Tri-County. So the way that we serve our community is not just symptom management. As we reviewed the Senate bills, I think the ultimate expectations is to improve health and reduce costs. So we consider our way of serving our community is highly efficient and cost effective. So the way that our constituents need help is to be engaged in a culturally sensitive manner and also being empowered to understand and navigate through the current healthcare systems. Not only our counselor can provide clinical interventions, we can also help the other provider to understand how to better serve our community. So I would like to summarize our offer in the following 6 points, and I would like to have our co-chair to share her perspective. We consider with our collective experience, we can provide clear data and information about the needs and successful approach to help care for racially and ethnically diverse and refugees consumers. We, as myself as a clinical social worker, together with our partner, we can provide integrated goals of racial and ethnic implement key healthcare integration goals for our constituents. We have a group of medical provider, psychiatrists, mental health professional, A&D counselor, case managers, and peer specialists who are all culturally belong to their community. Other than that, we can provide significant experience and information on care for severe trauma for racially and ethnically diverse refugees populations, including torture survivor. Other than that, we can offer our experience and support the system to outreach and train other primary care and other providers working with the ethnically and racially diverse refugees and immigrant populations. We can also develop matrix that evaluate model of care involving racially and ethnically diverse populations. Last but not the least, is we can provide cost-effective model of care to consider for all the tri-county consumer, which could engage consumer well, keep them in the treatments, and produce good outcomes. So Jackie can share her perspective.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jackie Mercer. I'm the CEO of the Native American Rehabilitation Association, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity to be here today and talk with you all. So the first thing I would say is I agree with Holden. The second thing is sort of just in looking at the process that we're undergoing now with the sort of the transformation and the movement of the responsibility for services from essentially from the state to the community care organizations. The guidance that you all give them is really critical that they carry out the mission. We have always felt support from the state, support from you all, the legislature, in terms of going forward. And, you know, there is always some concern, how will the CCOs interpret this, the messages that you all give, and will they carry those forward? So the support for our communities is really what we're seeking. And as Holden said, we have a lot of expertise and things to offer. I think that one of the things that sort of comes to me is the governance structure and also the community advisory committees. And is there any way to ask or for you all to require that they consider making sure that they have members of our community present on those committees? The second thing is really about the, you know, the data and the sort of the, I think it's called a clinical advisory panel, you know, one size doesn't fit all of just about anything, and when you start to look at outcomes and programs and what works, they have to really be, if you want them to be tailored, and which I know you do, and culturally appropriate, then we have to consider those in the process. And if that's not, again, part of that, then it can't be included in sort of how we're evaluated, because, you know, there may be different outcomes that are appropriate, and there may be different approaches, and we know that that's, those things are true. And then, you know, I just want to say that, you know, we appreciate the partnership, and we appreciate, again, the opportunity to be here, and there are lots of ways in which we can help. It's not really about being culturally appropriate. I think our people, you all know that we've done, as collective groups, way more than be just appropriate. You know, there's a dimension of competency. There's a dimension of trust that's developed in overcoming cultural barriers to eliminate disparities, which is your goal, for the most the people who have had the most disadvantage. And we know how to do that. And so we're just here to offer our support to you and ask how we can help that go forward. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it this time.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate Jackie. I've known you for a while, and I did appreciate the visit to your clinic a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I think if any of the other committee members have a chance to do that, I think that's important. I want to thank you, Holden, for being here. Senator Gordley, thank you for giving me that call and saying, get these people on your agenda. All right.
She still kind of gets what she wants.
And that's a good thing.
Huh? All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
I'd like to call up Polk County Commissioner Craig Pope and Commissioner from Marion County, Janet Carlson.
You know her.
Oh, we know her, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Craig Pope, Polk County Commissioner, and apparently I'm going to be the gentleman here for the ladies and take the first arrows. I was here December 20th and gave testimony to a committee that, you know, we've all been, as commissioners around the state, very concerned about the governance components in 3650. And all of you and everybody that's interested in this and trying to make a difference has worked really hard. And I can tell you that the partners I sit here with today have tried. You know, we've been working very hard on trying to find a way to make all of this work without more intervention, legislative intervention, with what we had to work with. I testified in December that I was very concerned about the speed at which this legislation is being forced to take place. I still stand by that. And I'm looking for softer start dates so that we can actually get this done and put a business model together that works. I also understand from my peers in the building that there's a lot more sausage making going on outside in the hall that you all have to deal with before we get down to what we're really going to do. But I would ask you again to continue to remember that because of our statutory responsibilities as counties, that we need to have at least enough prescriptive language in the bill that gives us a seat at the table in oversight and making certain that the dollars flow as the dollars were meant to flow. I think we're all committed to solving the problem. We all understand the limits in the budgets. We understand the governor's initiative. I told the governor a few weeks ago in a meeting that when this first came out, I was 180 degrees off of his initiative. Today, however, with some of the things that he's been trying to put together, I certainly see some possibilities. But I've been very concerned from the business model component of this, some of the requirements that are in this. And the biggest one, of course, is the health information technology component. And you're all familiar with what that means. You've had lots of people tell you about it. We still don't have a clue on how we're going to pay for that. The only positive I can tell you that I've got today that makes me feel better about that is that, you know, the governor making the statement that he's trying to get seed money. And I'm hoping that as we move this forward, before this becomes a mandate, that we actually have some dollars pledged to this to make certain that these new businesses, these CCOs, as they get startup, have some real dollars that can come into it to help them be successful. So I would just let you all know that, again, as a county commissioner that's been at the table with the IPA and the hospitals locally and the community, I'm trying to help make a difference and help get this done. And I'm here to help continue to work forward. So I'm here for you if you need anything additional and would love the opportunity to stay engaged. Yep.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner and immediate past president of the Association of Oregon Counties. And let me state at the outset that the association has not taken an official position on the bill that we are hearing today, nor has Marion County taken an official position on the bill that we are hearing today. I testified before the joint committee in December and sort of just dusted off the same printed testimony and put a new date on it. So you're not really going to see much different. The concepts and the background of Marion County are pretty much the same as they were then. However, since then, both the Association of Oregon Counties and Marion County, our three commissioners and our health folks, have reviewed and responded to the CCO implementation proposal that came out from the Oregon Health Authority. It's certainly a mammoth amount of work, and we recognize and respect that. We had some suggestions, mostly around the governance issue, that we put into our written proposal. For us in this area, Marion and Polk, I think the governance issue is fine without additional language. We are working very well with our partners, and we are being offered a seat at the table. And I think other counties will probably need to speak for themselves, and since AOC doesn't have a position, but I have, you know, heard that in certain areas of the state it's not working quite as smoothly as it is for us. But I'd have no complaints about how it's working for us. Personally, I am interested in seeing a bill move forward this session. I think there are still, as I mentioned in December, a lot of items that need to be worked out. We are working right now on what kind of legal structure actually works for a public body and private bodies, and how do we meld that together? And yesterday we were talking about confidentiality agreements, and so can county commissioners sign a confidentiality agreement? Well, we really can't, to the extent that there are public records laws and public meeting laws that we have to adhere to, and that's not necessarily the way that the private sector works and how they do business. But we've got some really good people at the table that are committed to work those types of issues out, and we think that we can make something happen sooner rather than later. The last comment that I would make, I was before this committee testifying about early learning a few weeks ago and mentioned that there is a link between early learning and healthcare transformation. So now I will come from the opposite direction, testifying in healthcare transformation. There is a definite link between what we're doing in early learning, and I hope that everyone keeps that in mind as we move this forward. So that would be the extent of my testimony today.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Jan Buffa, and I'm Chief Executive Officer of the Willamette Valley Providers Health Authority and Marion Pope Community Health Plan. We are a taxable, not-for-profit mutual benefit company. Our health plan currently serves over 60,000 Oregon Health Plan clients in Marion and Polk County. Our boards tasked our management team with initiating conversations with the area healthcare partners, and we did so, not for the purpose of controlling or owning the process, but for the purpose of transforming and implementing healthcare transformation as envisioned by the governor and the legislators. We are currently working with a large group of area healthcare stakeholders. As Commissioner Carlson indicated, we're an informal work group. The groups expanded to include all of the healthcare partners in the service area, and our intent is to work towards CCO organizational certification. Individuals involved in this process thus far are Polk County and Human Services, Marion County Health Department, the Mid-Valley Behavioral Health Care Network, the four area hospitals, Atrial Medical Health Plans, the two community-based federally qualified health care clinics, SEIU, Area Long-Term Care Facility Partners, Family Building Blocks, Salem Clinic, and over 457 physicians in the Marion Polk County area who've already agreed through signing an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, to participate in the process through our organization. Other business leaders that are involved indirectly or directly include Sue Miller from Family Building Blocks, Dick Withnell of Withnell Motors. Again, we have Commissioners Carlson, Milne, and Commissioner Pope participating, and Representative Thompson has also attended meetings. Although we acknowledge that our work to date centers around structure and governance, we're excited about the prospects. We have had our clinicians from our respective organizations working throughout the year to implement clinical transformation for the purpose of implementing all the tenets of Triple Aim and to better integrate the delivery system within our region. We're excited about the prospects. We've had some wonderful outcomes already. We partnered with SEIU and the Northwest Senior Services Division on a CMS Innovations Grant, which was turned in last Friday. We also supported Silverton Health in their CMS Innovations Grant by preparing and providing letters of recommendation for Silverton Health. And we were also invited by Silverton Health to participate in a medical staff meeting this week in order to bring their medical staff up to date on what this informal CCO work group's accomplished to date. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today, and we look forward to the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I was aware of what's going on in the Tri-County area, but didn't realize the same homework is being done in this area. So it's exciting to see these entities that really have never talked to each other very much are talking to each other. So thank you.
We're certainly doing
yes,
so.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate what the commissioners have said. House Bill 3650 spoke about contractual relationships between CCOs and counties. Many of us have felt all along that counties should have a place on the board because of the risk model they have. And unfortunately, the only language we have is a language in 3650. This bill's silent on it, and I do think we need some definition in that as to who the major risk players are and the fact that they need to be part of the governance structure. For the record.
Okay. No further comment. Thank you very much for coming. I'd like to call Ed Blackburn, Cindy Becker from the Tri-County Medical Medicaid Collaborative, and Doug Riggs from the Oregon Primary Care Association.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug Riggs here on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association. I will be brief since you all hear me every day, and I'd rather have a lot of the other folks in the room. OPCA wants to express their appreciation for moving this process forward. This has been something that's been in the works since really the Westland Bates interim hearings many years ago, and so it's really exciting to see transformation move to this step. We're very proud of Oregon's efforts to transform healthcare, and you've created a good process through the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Health Policy Board to move this along. We were very impressed by the board's willingness to take input from people around the state, which they did, and incorporate those comments into their final version that came up in January 24th, and we're greatly encouraged by the process that they've undertaken. Senate Bill 1580 recommends adopting this plan, and we believe that this is a good starting point to the discussion. Certain amendments, such as psychological and social barriers to health, should be addressed at some point, either in the legislative process or in the Ways and Means process. We expect that this will be an ongoing process, and we thank you for getting it started today. So, without further ado, that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. Before Ed Blackburn and I begin our testimony, I would like to make a couple of comments that were a follow-up from the last time that we met with you. I wanted to let you know that the Tri-County Collaborative will be asking the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Nurses Association, for representation on the Executive Steering Committee. The second thing I wanted to let you know is that I think it was Senator Cruz or some other folks mentioned the need for more communication with stakeholders, and we are holding a meeting on the 8th. I think that's sometime next week. And we have, at this point, I think about 75 people that we have invited and will be coming to that meeting to give them an update on where we're going and how we go from here in terms of engaging meaningful stakeholder input. The collaborative is also going to be inviting local, state, and federal elected officials to a meeting. The elected officials from across the three counties, we are going to be inviting you to a meeting to talk about and give you a briefing of where we are in the collaborative and where we're not, quite honestly. So are there any questions about those three things before we move forward with our testimony?
No, I don't. I particularly want to, well, I know maybe someone else does, but I do want to say when you involve the legislators, sometimes just a phone call, at least from my standpoint, to just let us know what's happening is extremely helpful.
Great. Well, we will definitely be setting up some briefing sessions with the elected officials, and we can do that on a regular basis.
Thank you very much.
So with that, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Ed Blackburn, and he's going to kick off our formal testimony.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity once again today. Briefly, the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative is made up of public and private organizations. The vision of the collaborative is to create an integrated community delivery system that will achieve better community health for Medicaid and high-risk uninsured populations in the Tri-County community, in which all stakeholders invest by committing resources or dollars to the effort. First, for the record, the Tri-County Collaborative supports the recommendations of the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Oregon Health Authority. It was a transparent public process, and we are appreciative of the leadership that they have provided on health care reform. Therefore, we support the bill moving out to the Ways and Means Committee as soon as possible. We do have some suggested changes today, though. Those changes are offered in the spirit of supporting the work that is ongoing in our community and building on the work of the OHPB. As we mentioned when we were here a few weeks ago, it'll take a few months for the collaborative to organize and develop into a structured entity. Given that, we are offering an amendment for consideration by the committee. We offer these concepts to help ensure that the important options exist for the collaborative going forward after the legislative session concludes, allowing the collaborative to develop in the best way to serve the Tri-County area. The four concepts we'd like to offer for your consideration are in the areas of 1, information sharing, 2, fast track, 3, governance, and 4, finance. On the information sharing, the rules regarding sharing of clinical information for patient care between health care providers should not be more restrictive than the current HIPAA requirements. In order to make the CCO function as designed and to truly coordinate and integrate the care for patients, we need to remove unnecessary barriers for information sharing. The integration of behavioral health, including mental and chemical dependency care, is currently prohibited without special release of information approvals. So in order to facilitate the sharing of this crucial information across healthcare settings to assist in care or integration, we'd like to request a waiver from the federal government to allow this information to be shared more easily when appropriate. In addition to a request for the waiver, we would suggest that the legislation direct the health authority to create rules that will facilitate and clarify the CCO's ability to share information between providers. And with that, I'm going to turn over the others to Cindy Becker.
Thank you. The next topic that we'd like to give you a heads up about in terms of amendments is what's called the fast track. The collaborative supports legislation that promotes cooperation, flexibility, and ingenuity. Specifically, the collaborative would like to ensure that legislation aimed at fast tracking CCO determination does not inadvertently create incentives for managed care organizations participating in the collaborative to pursue CCO determination alone, and that it allows for sufficient flexibility for organizations to be provider-led. Excuse me. The collaborative supports incentivizing the organizations of CCOs with additional funding to help defray the costs of transforming and encourage early adopters of the CCO model. We feel that any incentives that the state is able to obtain, they should be established and distributed in a way that encourages collaboration across the community's Medicaid system. We believe that any incentives should be commensurate to the complexity and size of the Medicaid population served by a CCO, as well as the degree of innovation and transformation that is occurring in the CCO. We strongly discourage a two-tiered certification process. We believe that all CCOs should be certified based upon demonstrating ability to meet the same criteria, the criteria that was deliberated by the CCO work groups over the past year and the OHPB in an open public process during the interim. The next area deals with governance. As we work to establish, organize, and develop the model of care for the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative, we are looking at a variety of different ways to organize as a legal entity to explore the most appropriate governance structure that will support the principles of the collaborative. And I'd briefly like to go over those principles. One is a collective caregiver-led initiative, optimal system design, maximize resources available, accept global financing technology, design care for population needs, including person-centered primary care home, integration of physical, mental health, addictions, and oral health, align and coordinate specialty care, and focus on prevention. One of the other principles is pay or play, that entities get involved either through financially or by providing services. We're also interested in transitions of care across the continuum and end-user consumer-oriented system. In order to accomplish this, we would suggest changes to the legislation that provide for and allow flexibility in the type of governance of a CCO. Specifically, we ask that coordinated care organizations be allowed allowed, and this is permissive legislation if they would like to, that they be allowed to establish themselves as private nonprofit organizations, as public corporations, or through contractual relationships such as a joint venture. Last and not least, it deals with antitrust laws. Federal and state antitrust laws prohibit competitors from discussing pricing and or coordinating allocation of territories. States can insulate this activity so long as it is declared to be a quote-unquote matter of state concern in order to protect the public's health, safety, or welfare. But that declaration needs to be in statute. Obviously, there are a number of competitors working in the Tri-County Collaborative, and as you've heard, in other collaboratives as well, and we're going to be working together to form the CCO, and we cannot perform all those functions without that type of protection. Last but not least, generally, we want to make sure that the legislature, through the bill that's passed, is promoting the ability to maximize federal resources as much as possible. We want to make sure that we can leverage every federal dollar that's available. So in closing, thank you for the opportunity, and we would welcome any questions that you have.
Questions? Yes, Senator Bates.
A couple comments and then a question, okay? First off, I think that we've all moved past the idea of fast-tracking organizations. There may well be early adopters simply because in some communities which are smaller and more geographically defined, they can move forward faster and quicker. We understand that.
Right.
Okay, so there will be a common ground, a common path for CCOs to form. I think we've all pretty well agreed to that.
Perfect.
And our federal partners, frankly, like that a lot more, and they've got the money, so we're paying attention to them, okay? And so from that point of view, I don't think there's much here that there's a disagreement on. Your second issue was about governance. We're still all struggling with that, of course, and how much leeway do we give individual communities to do this or not is an open question yet. And the only thing you said there that kind of concerns me, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about, is the pay or play concept. The governance is for the good of the population being served, to get better outcomes, to be certain those people are taken care of, and to drive down cost. If you get on the board because you bring more money to the board, but you don't get there because you're a county, or you don't get there because you're a provider who is actually in the trenches taking care of these people, or if you're in a mental health organization and don't have a lot of money to bring to the table, we really don't want this designed to be that if whoever has the most bucks runs the board, runs the organization. I don't think you meant that, but I'd like to get on the record that you didn't.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, that's correct. We were not talking about the governance. It doesn't mean that you have to pay to get on the board. We weren't implying that. We were talking about being involved in the CCO itself.
Okay. Follow up. The board is extremely important, and the majority of board members have to be at risk. That's in the bill and will stay in the bill. I just want to be absolutely certain that we understand each other, that we have concerns if all board members or the majority of board members are only from large organizations that have a large share of cost, and that is the criteria for getting on the board. We don't want that to be the only criteria.
And Senator, we, as we look at forming the board, we are obviously going to pay attention to the spirit and the language in House Bill 3650 in terms of involving community members and involving consumers.
And Madam Chair and Senator, even though the current Executive Steering Committee is not synonymous with the future board, the start we got off includes the three counties of the Tri-County area on the board, on the steering committee, and myself. I'm the Executive Director of Central City Concern, but I represent the metro area community health centers on the board. And we have about 25 different organizations now that are involved in the various committees doing the committee work. They're mostly community-based organizations. So I think we got off to a good start and we're heading in that direction, but your point is well taken.
Thank you. And one last comment, if I
yes,
could.
Please do.
And one of the other areas we're struggling with is, and this goes back to early adopters and to all adopters, is experience and ability to handle risk. People have to have experience. One of the partners, at least, as a minimum, has to have experience in handling risk for populations. And what those reserves will be set commensurate with those risks are still open questions. And how we'll place that in the bill or leave it open is still uncertain. but that has to be part of the discussion we're going to have ongoing here. And I think you're all aware of it. I assume you're probably struggling with that as much as we are right now.
We are.
We don't want any of these to fail.
No. Right.
Okay. We agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. No further discussion. Thank you so much for coming. We
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Eric Carlson from the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. And let's have Dr. Bob Dannenhofer from, and Kelly Moran from Mercy, Morgan from Mercy Medical.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Eric Carlson. I'm with the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. We are a broad-based organization of about 20 churches, labor union locals, and community organizations, and we've been following this process since you began it basically in the 2007 session with the Health Fund Board. We are supportive of Senate Bill 1580. We also have concerns with governance. We represent consumers, and we are concerned about having the CCOs set up so that they are helpful and will achieve. Their focus will be the triple aim, and their focus will not be solely on the bottom line. We would note that House Bill 3650 provides each member of a CCO must be encouraged to be an active partner in directing the member's health and not be a passive recipient of care. And we think that ought to be applied to governance so that the community is an active participant in governance and not just somebody to whom care is delivered. Largely, this is because we look at the practicalities of people being on a board. The current implementation proposal provides the minimum is one member of the community at large on a CCO board, and we don't think that's going to work. Our folks have served on boards of all kinds. When you're alone on issues, when you're the lone representative, it's really tough to do the pushing and prodding that a community representative needs to do if you're the only one there, just in terms of maintaining relations with other board members. So our suggestion is put in a minimum requirement that one-third of the members of a CCO board be from the community. There are a number of ways that would play out depending on the size of the board, but we really think the community needs to be much better represented than is currently the minimum under the implementation proposal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Bob Dannenhofer. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm from Douglas County. Douglas County has long been involved in healthcare transformation. A group of us from the county of healthcare leaders have been meeting over the last several years, and we've been meeting over the last several years. We were looking forward to some changes in healthcare, and when the transformation bill, House Bill 3650, came through, this was right exactly what we were considering. Since that time, we've been working together to form a CCO, and nine groups within our county have gotten together and have formed into a 501c3 corporation with the aim of becoming the first CCO in the state. Those groups include the hospital, the doctor's group, the federally qualified health center, the Medicare Advantage plan, the county commissioners, the county mental health, and the local A&D providers, as well as the three managed care organizations that have already been providing care in the county. There's a lot of experience there. The SIP has been doing this for 17 years. Advantage Dental and Gobi have been doing for a long time. Seven of those nine people are people from the community. And in addition, we have a community advisory board. The chair of the community advisory board will be on the board, and another community member will be on the board. So I think we've met the ideas that most people thought in 3650 for lots of community representation, as well as representation by the major parts of the community, as well as the risk-bearing entities. We don't know how it's going to work, and we still have a lot of questions about the details of how this will work. For example, the County is very concerned about the Mental Health Authority and how that money and responsibility will flow. We're very concerned about the reserve requirements. We're all relatively small organizations, and we need some clarity as to how those will work. And, for example, our Medicare Advantage plan has some real concerns about how the waivers will work, especially the dual eligible waiver, because the details of that will be absolutely critical to their continued functioning. One of the areas that we're most concerned about is how we're going to deal with both innovation and regulation. I mean, right now, our plan has 40 different people at DMAP we have to talk to. The mental health plan has more than 40, and the dental health plan has a similar amount. We're concerned that when we conglomerate these together, we're going to have 120 different people asking us for information, as well as if the regulations don't change and we still are bound by some of the regulations we have, we're going to be stifled in our innovation. And I would strongly encourage that the Oregon Health Authority think very clearly and carefully about how we can both stir innovation and have enough regulation so that none of these plans fail. Thank you.
And as it's been posed to me, it's the innovator concept, the innovator agent or representative that will be the liaison between the CCO and the Oregon Health Authority, correct?
We could hope.
Yes. All right.
I'm Kelly Morgan. I'm the CEO of Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. And as Dr. Danenhofer had mentioned, I think we're as close as anybody to be the first CCO. And I think that has a lot to do with some relationships that we've built up over the years. But if there's one theme that we would urge the committee to consider as we finalize the rules and the regs, we need to have as much flexibility as we possibly can. I mean, if we're going to have a lot of burdensome regulation, if we're going to have a lot of expectations, whether it be on standards, whether it be on quality issues, whether it be on evidence-based practices, the more of those regulations you put on us, the less likely that transformation is going to occur. And I think it probably goes without saying, but I'll state the obvious, is for most of us, OHP is not a lucrative health plan. So the more regulation you have, the less likely that that is going to occur. So the other point I want to leave with you is that the more flexibility you can provide to us as a local CCO with less state oversight, it's going to be better for us locally also.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Danenhofer or the others, I was intrigued that you've incorporated as a 501c3, and for the others who might be thinking about what the proper corporate structure would be, can you help me understand how you got, how you're getting around kind of the basic theme in the nonprofit law that, you know, the benefits cannot inure to the board members?
Right. We carefully considered whether we want to do this as a for-profit or not-for-profit. The concern in doing this in a for-profit corporation is that many of our members are not-for-profit entities, and they would have some difficulties being in a for-profit corporation. We do not think that the benefits are going to inure to any of the individual members. I mean, I'm not going to get rich on this, I don't think. But we think the people in the county will do well with this. We already had a 501c3 that was not doing very much, and thus we rolled this into the 501c3 that we'd already had to go ahead and do that. I'm not sure this is the only or even the right way to do it, but it's the first way to do it, and it was a way that we could all work together and make this happen. You know, there's still trust building. We work together a lot in the county. We know each other by first name. We've been working with each other for a long time, but still it takes some trust building. We thought a 501c3 was the best way to encourage that trust building.
Okay. Follow-up. So my sense then is that the revenue will come in and it will stay within the 501c3 rather than be dispersed to the different...
Well, we don't see that the 501c3 could in any quick time have all the employees that you need to go ahead and do this. And we think that you'll need to have several hundred employees even in Douglas County to do it. At least in the beginning, we think we would do this as a network of providers. So the money would come into the 501c3 and then the places that could handle it would handle it. Within time, we think that we'll be better coordinated to perhaps have a single structure, but that's well down the road. I mean, I will tell you, that will take a long time to build. There's no way you could ever get that done by July, and to get it done by July, we think the best way to do it is to bring it into the CCO, perhaps, and then bring it out to the organizations that already do it.
That's great. Madam Chair, just again, I'm not being critical at all, but I think that a lot of other counties are struggling with what the right corporate structure is, and I'm sure you've got lawyers who are wrestling with those very issues, and just if you can and inform us as you move along what the pitfalls might be of the path you've chosen so that we can inform the rest of the state, that would be very helpful.
We would be happy to.
And again, I can't, Senator Morris.
Oh, thank you. Doctor, you referenced several hundred employees. That are these new employees in that to create the CCO and make it function?
We think there'll probably be several hundred people needed to do this. We're already employing them for our MCO business. The county is already employing some for the mental health business, and the dental organizations already have some. So there are going to be a number of people who needed to put together and gather all this information that DBAP asks of us. And we don't think they're going to necessarily be new jobs. We think it's just going to be a different organization of the current jobs that are there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification, because I had heard that you're going to create 300 new jobs, and one of the tasks of this enterprise is to save money, and we raise that bar a little higher if we're approaching it that way.
We would hope for 300 new jobs at Douglas County, but not this way.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, and I would suggest Senator Morris, if we want to keep that number down as far as the administrative side, we can streamline the accountability functions, which we probably will be doing. I'd also like to say that one of the things I like about the 501 structure, because transparency is one of the things we're after, and that separation from the members, I think, will lend itself to that sort of transparency. And Doctor, long term, I'm assuming, are you looking at the CCO being the carrier of the risk, and how are you going to form that?
Well, we would need to see how that would work. For example, if it was a 501c3 and the risk reserves were high, it would be hard for 501c3 to generate enough cash or to come onto enough cash to go ahead and do those reserves. We think the premium in Douglas County is going to be north of $70 million if indeed the revenue requirements for risk reserves is, say, $6 million. There's no way a 501c3 could raise $6 million in reserve capital quickly. So some of these questions will come there. Now, DSIP already has some risk reserves, Advantage Dental and Gobi do, so we have to figure out how to make that work. But the devil will really be in these details.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Chair, I know we only have a limited time. This is a golden opportunity to ask some questions, if you bear with me. Two questions for Dr. Dannenhofer, one for Mr. Kelly. On the point of contact, the innovator program that you've suggested, which we think is actually pretty brilliant, quite frankly, having dealt with OHP a few times myself. It's a very simple question, but if you think about it, it's kind of important. Do you want that person embedded in your organization right in Roseburg, or would you rather have them up in Salem? What would work best for you?
I would much prefer that this person be right in Roseburg and right at our plan. I sent out this article that Atul Gawande wrote about the county extension agents helping farmers along the way. We would like this person in the plan. You know, there's been this talk about how would you assure that the community advisory board was really working. The best way to do it would be to have this innovator agent be there. It would probably take them about 10 minutes to tell whether this was a real advisory board or this was just... this is just for show. We'd love to have those people there. We're going to have questions. For example, there may be a question about cultural competency. I think in Douglas County we will struggle with cultural competency since we're kind of a homogenous organization. Wouldn't it be great if our innovator agent could talk with people in Portland who have better experience and tell us how to do it? If we did a particularly great community needs assessment, wouldn't it be great if the innovator agents could work together and work with people in Salem to figure out how to do that? So we would welcome the innovator agent living right in our building.
Second question. You've also suggested something else that I thought was pretty brilliant also. That's a reinsurance pool for the CCOs set up on a statewide basis and funded by the CCOs. Could you give us a few comments on that?
You know, this is a risky business we're going to do. This is not a business where the costs are evenly distributed. We think in our organization that on several areas that 11% of the population uses 89% of the money. On the other way around, 89% of the people only use 11% of the money. So there's a huge insurance function here. And in small areas, especially areas with less than, say, 50,000 insured, there is going to be an issue for risk reinsurance. And risk reinsurance is a thing which is not predictable on a small scale, but is very predictable on a large scale. And at the state scale, we may be able to do this and may be able to both save money and allow small plans to be successful and protect them against the extraordinary risk. For example, if you had premium triplets, which could easily happen, premium triplets could cost you $1 million each, and $3 million for a small plan would be enough to put them under. So risk reinsurance is something that we might do collectively and actually do to good effect.
Thank you. Madam Chair, last question, Mr. Kelly. One of the things being discussed and try to grapple with is risk and reserves. And one of the suggestions has been that we, because we're going to have dual eligibles, because we're going to have Medicare involved, that we look at Medicare Advantage programs, look at their requirements, both for metrics and both for risk and for reserves. And generally speaking, in this state, that runs through DCBS. Do you think that's an avenue we should explore?
Well, I think right now is back to my comment about flexibility. Anything that makes some sense, I think we should explore it. I still look at this as a trust game with our partners, and if it makes some sense for our community, if it makes some sense for all of our medical providers to participate in it, then I think everything should be considered.
Follow up. Would you get back to me later on a little bit more on this?
Sure.
These are the devil of the details we're really starting to grapple with, yep. And we need to have some clarity on that. I've talked to Bill Murray, you, and some others. I'd like to hear more about this and really drill down on some of the stuff that really is going to make or break these situations. Thank you.
And I'm thinking about the fiscal costs. You know, I think that the value of a metrics, a transparent process in the metrics, setting metrics is extremely important. But then I also see the fiscal issue. And so we're going to weigh that, as well as the innovation agents that we want, but all very important. But again, I can't help but applaud you. Trust is extremely important in the relationships, and you have counties, you have hospitals, there are MCOs. You're competitors. You've always been competitors, and the fact that you are now working together, I think, is extremely, I applaud you for doing that. It is a huge change, and I think some of us are very uncomfortable with change, but I think in order for it to happen, I think we're going around with the right process. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could make one brief comment on the sort of transparency metrics issue. Our folks are really concerned about that. At one point in my checkered employment history, I was a coordinator for watershed councils and was active trying to get them to work together statewide. And we did some conferences where we learned about how you rebuild watersheds. And the constant advice we got, well, we had constant complaints from members of the council. They didn't want to put any, they didn't want to waste any money on evaluation. And the constant advice we got from the professionals was, if you can't afford to evaluate, you can't afford the project. And I would like you to be really careful before you start chopping money from metrics and evaluation so that we know what's going on with this.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Appreciate that.
All right, with that, we'd like to move forward with Ken Hector from Silverton Health, Karen Nibbler from the League of Women Voters, and Sherry Ramirez from the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs.
Chair Montesanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I am Ken Hector, and somebody graciously signed me up, so I'm just going to say that I appreciate the comments that have been before me, and particularly those from Jan Boffa, and I will suggest that the support for 1580 should go forward. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you. Chair
Anderson and Chair Cruz, I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and my name is Karen Nibbler. And we wanted, actually I sent a letter in support of this bill, and I hope that you received it today.
We have.
Did you? You did. Okay, good. Okay, we wanted to support the transformation efforts and particularly to commend the Oregon Health Policy Research Group that did a lot of the work for this, and also the two committees, the two health committees. We think you've done an enormous amount of work, and we're really pleased with how this bill is developing. And we had a great internal discussion in our own group, because we had a lot of members who wanted single payer, and they hung on to this idea of single payer till the end of last session. And it's kind of a long-term goal for a lot of our members that they want to have the single payer. But some of us are more pragmatic, and we think that any steps that you take in this process of improving the system is good, and we want to encourage any of those steps in this process. And we really like some of the things in this bill. You know, we like the prevention focus, and we like medical homes, and we like the team of professionals that are working together, and we like working on chronic diseases, and including dental. And I think that's a very important part, because a lot of people, if they don't have their dental things treated, are going to get physically more sick. And also the mental illness and how that integrates with physical health. And we think with cost control, that's a huge issue. A lot of luck with that. I think it's going to be really difficult, but hopefully that's something that will happen. Anyway, we wanted to commend you in your efforts towards this transformation, and we're looking forward to seeing how this is implemented.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Our membership represents county-based community mental health programs that plan, coordinate, and contract with mental health, addictions, and developmental disabilities providers. I just want to state our support for Senate Bill 1580 as the path to person-centered primary care homes and the integration of physical, behavioral, and dental health care. Just a couple of observations as a relative newcomer to Oregon. I'm really impressed by the bipartisanship of your legislature. I don't think you would have gotten this far, would continue changing a system this big without it. I think it's crucial. Most states, including the one that I come from, which is Illinois, have the same vision of better health, better care, and lower cost, but Oregon truly is a pioneer in how to get there, and other states are looking to Oregon as a role model. So I'd like to express my sincere appreciation for the legislature in getting us to this point, the Oregon Health Policy Board for their thoughtful implementation proposal, and for the Oregon Health Authority staff, who I'm sure did a whole lot of work with each iteration of that proposal. So I'd just like to say a word about the role of community mental health program directors. They have a somewhat unique role in that they're both experts in behavioral health and they represent county government. And so they can really serve as boundary spanners among government, providers, health organizations. And because of their behavioral health expertise, they're really good at relationship building, so which is crucial for the successful CCO development. All of our members want to be and are involved in the CCO development process in their respective regions and counties. And statewide, several of our members have participated in work groups for the implementation proposal. We also look forward to serving on a technical advisory group to establish core metrics as far as behavioral health type metrics. And then lastly, I want to recognize the role of mental health organizations and the fine work that they do that is innovative, evidence-based, and helps keep people in their communities leading meaningful and productive lives. They really know person-centered planning and care with programs such as Aim High, Early Psychosis Intervention, and Wraparound. And mental health organizations are truly an integral component of coordinated care. And in fact, one will apply to be a CCO with our enthusiastic support. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Oregon.
Thank you.
Yes, glad to have you here. The weather's much better here.
It is.
Than Illinois. And thank you very much. Is there questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Deborah Loy from Capital Dental Care, Janet Ahrens from Alliance of Children, and Craig Opperman.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We are a statewide association representing $180 million worth of services to children and families, 7,000 employees, 95,000 children. We are also known as the Alliance, as our colleagues are, and we have some shared memberships, including Central City Concern and NARA, and just a brief endorsement for their comments. The 800,000 lives in the Oregon Health Plan that are represented, 380,000 of them are children. But when you take a look at the agendas, the conversations, the stakeholder representations, and the processes, we have a hard time finding, we certainly don't expect half of those slots to be filled by advocates and providers for children, but we have a hard time finding a reasonable portion of slots that do represent children. Even the conversation here today and the testimony so far this afternoon, we've been hard-pressed to find the word child mentioned in the testimonies. You have some material in front of you. You know all of the numbers and the records on what happens to kids who suffer trauma in their homes. And so I'm not going to repeat any of that. I just do want to remind folks that childhood trauma is the pipeline to chronic health illness for adults. The nonprofit organizations and the providers that take care of children when they've suffered trauma in their homes are the agencies and the entities that can help keep these kids from being the 20% that eat the 80% of the resources. Also, as a second piece of paper in front of you, and I'm very, very pleased that we have heard the word transparency many times today, and so we just want to reiterate our healthcare transformation policy objectives, how important transparency is, and again, reiterate how important it is to make sure that children are part of the conversation. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members. I'm Craig Opperman. I am with Looking Glass Youth and Family Services in Lane County, and I'm also the Vice President for Public Affairs of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I'm going to make a few brief comments from my testimony that I've given you, but I don't think I've ever testified after hearing everybody in front of me say things that I heartily agree and endorse with so much. It's been really nice to hear everybody's comments. They're right in line with what my thoughts are. I do want to just mention and emphasize that while physical health care funding is an ocean compared to the lake of behavioral health care funding, please don't underestimate that exponential saving power that exists in that smaller pool, and you've heard us discuss that. I really appreciated the comments earlier in that regard from Senator Bates. The governor's story of a $400 air conditioner saving $50,000 in emergency room costs for an elderly congestive heart failure patient is a perfect example. Right now, as we sit here, there are hundreds of community treatment specialists, counselors, and therapists doing mental health and alcohol and drug treatment services in homes with children and families. They know if a parent is not taking their diabetes medication, if they need meds for depression to avoid a suicide attempt, or if there are substance abuse issues to address. These community workers know if the teenage client they're dealing with is worried about their grandmother who has a heart condition that's living in a hot upstairs apartment. So we simply need to ensure that these workers are empowered and connected to the physical health care system in a meaningful way. The cost savings and return on this investment would be significant. So I really endorse the comments that say that we need to ensure that CCOs are accountable and transparent and inclusive. And I really have appreciated what folks have said, and I'd really like to emphasize the first people that spoke
in terms of communities of color and how we need to address that. And I think that our community workers and the nonprofits and a lot of folks that are out there in these homes and communities now can really help us make sure that all communities are meaningfully engaged in this process. Thank you. Thanks for all you're doing.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Senator Cruz, thank you for allowing me to be here. My name is Deborah Loy, for the record, and I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care, which is a dental care organization contracted with the Oregon Health Plan. So these are exciting times with transformation, and in looking through both House Bill 3650 and the implementation plan that was just released, I have a couple of items of concern. I would like to state that others have also indicated how important that governance piece is, and there seems to be three key criteria under the governance, one being financial risk, one being major components of the healthcare delivery system, and one being community. It is really up for interpretation what that means for a dental plan. So whether we are or are not a major component of the healthcare delivery system, or what risk means in that we are small plans and obviously don't have a ginormous amount of capital that we can bring to the table, but we certainly can be at risk for member care and for our reserves, or are dentists part of the community of care that's being formed around these CCOs. Another component of the criteria of the implementation plan is that on or before 7/1/14, each CCO will have a formal contract relationship with any DCO in the service area, and any has recently been interpreted by legal counsel, I believe, as meaning all, because it had been narrowly interpreted as being one. Am I? Sorry. Some of the emerging CCOs may have some of their own dental capacity, but it's unclear how they anticipate integrating the dental care organizations that are also in their community with provider panels and a delivery system to add to that capacity. 7/1/14 should not be the ultimate goal. It hopefully is in the best interest of the community and the CCO to work towards a much earlier contract relationship with the DCOs. The proposed RFA response to that question should not just be that's way far away in the future, I don't have to worry about that. There should be a robust questions that are answered on how they anticipate getting to that ultimate goal. The CCO implementation proposal has transition strategies and transitional provisions for other types of situation, but little of it speaks to dental. Without a plan for oral health and the DCOs to be integrated, it leaves wide variances of interpretation and potentially sets up the likelihood of a failure of that transition to go well. And certainly, I think that it doesn't have to delay us, but I do think that we need to have some clarity and some intent and some insight into what that is supposed to mean. Our organization's is fully committed to transformation and trying to figure out how to do this differently and better. So totally, whether in right from the get-go or coming in later or coming in the middle, we're going to be helping figuring out how to do this better, more cost-effective, and give better care. Many DCOs echo these same concerns that I've expressed. We're working as a group with the Oregon Health Authority on rule language, and that's a great first step, and hopefully clarity from the legislative body would even improve that step. I would like to call and compliment, there are some communities with emergent CCOs that have brought dental to the table in the dental plans, and I would hope to see more of that, and again, with
clarity, maybe that will help pave that way. The Oregon Health Policy Board has indicated that they have not really had dental in front of them, has agreed to do that, and I would hope that that actually takes place. And in the rapid forming of CCOs and all the other stuff that's going on, I totally understand and get that sometimes it's easy not to sort of embrace every part of the delivery system. And I hope that in the very near future, we can actually get to the oral health component.
Thank you. Well, the intent of the 3650 was definitely to include mental health, dental, physical addictions. Again, we're in the infancy of this, and if there are problems in omissions, believe me, we'll all hear about it, and we'll take care of it. All right. No further discussion.
Thank you.
All right. Vern Sabo, Steve Kafori, and Laura Farr.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Vern Sabo. I'm a chiropractic physician from Albany representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. And we are in support of 1580. But what is very important to us is Section 8, which is the non-discrimination piece. It has been about 20 months now since in the back patio of Phil Donovan's folks' place in Corvallis that I asked then candidate Dr. John Kitzhopper if in fact he supported the federal language that was inserted into the Accountable Care Act, which was a non-discrimination piece. And he said absolutely. He said that there's a real opportunity for chiropractic and naturopathic physicians, for example, who wish to practice to the height of their licensure to help fill the primary care provider void. And that's reflected in this bill that he's written in that Section 8. We have some 1,500 licensed chiropractic physicians in the state that can help step up for those who wish to practice primary care. It's also, I think, important to note that the outreach by the Oregon Health Authority to the public with the statewide roundtable discussions, resoundingly, consumers came to the microphone and stated their concerns that they can see the chiropractic, naturopathic physicians, acupuncturists, and other licensed professionals, and supported non-discrimination language, which would not allow coordinated care organizations to discriminate against any health care provider practicing within their scope, licensure, or certification. A little later, the Oregon Health Policy Board asked for public comment by way of email, and last month published their public summary of the public comments. And part and parcel to this, the non-discrimination language, the public had sent in over 250 emails. It was bolded. It was the greatest response they had of all the issues, stating that they wanted the non-discrimination piece so, in fact, they could see the provider of their choice. The current language is consistent with federal language. The language in the bill is from the federal Medicaid non-discrimination regulatory language, which was the template that our federal coalition used to write Section 2706 or the Harkin Amendment. So we're in support of 1580 and near and dear to our hearts is that Section 8. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Laura Culberson Farr. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. We also would like to speak specifically to Section 8 of this. We are in support of Senate Bill 1580 generally, and concur with a lot of the other concerns that have been voiced, but Section 8 is something that I think Vern has done a good job of providing the context of why Section 8 for non-discrimination was included in this bill, and it was from the tremendous outpouring of public comment and public input demanding access to the patient's provider of choice. And as the system moves to covering hundreds of thousands of more lives in just a few years, It's really darn important that we make sure that every provider is practicing to the top of their license if we're going to meet the needs of all of those new people coming under the system. I've testified to the Oregon Health Policy Board in the past that there are two ways of making sure that all of these lives have adequate access to care. One of them is passive, and one of them is proactive. And this non-discrimination language is honestly on the passive spectrum of things. It's the most passive way of responding to the tremendous input, the volume of input that the OHA received from real people asking from choice. It leaves open still so many unknowns, and I'd like to clarify just one particular example that we're very concerned with is the open card or fee-for-service patients in the Oregon Health Plan. Fee-for-service patients who have their claims processed directly by the state of Oregon can currently see a naturopathic physician for their primary care. Thousands of patients see naturopathic doctors currently for all of their primary care. And as you know, naturopathic doctors are licensed as primary care providers. We have a full scope, full formulary privileges for everything you would need in a primary care setting. And counterpoint to that, only about 15% or so of Oregon Health Plan patients have an open card or are fee-for-service patients, and the remaining 85% or so are managed by managed care organizations. And MCOs almost categorically refuse to credential naturopathic doctors. We've been given reasons ranging from we're owned by MDs, so we're unlikely to credential other types of providers, all the way to our leadership is philosophically opposed to naturopathic medicine, which is refreshing in its honesty, but not quite how good public policy is made for the general population of the state. And how this could play out, and our biggest concern is Yamhill County is just one particular example I'd like to use. In Yamhill County, Yamhill County has the highest percentage of open card patients, I believe, in the state. About 600 of those patients are currently managed and seen by one naturopathic clinic in that county. As those open card patients are moved into CCOs, what will happen to those patients who currently see an ND for their primary care, thousands of them if you extrapolate this across the state, if that community's CCO decides that it doesn't like the color of our stripes, where that they're philosophically opposed to naturopathic medicine by their leadership? Where will those patients go? So this non-discrimination language, it does a little bit, but it doesn't do a lot to ensure that those patients will have continuity of care and that they'll continue to be able to access their naturopathic physician. It does little to respond to patient demand to have a choice of their provider going forward in the program. It is reusing federal language, as Vern implied. And so you're probably asking yourself, why am I here today supporting this language? And it is a step forward in some direction. And our support for it today comes from the place that it's critically essential as a structural foundation to set the stage that the Oregon Health Authority, the governor's staff, and you as legislators expect CCOs to respond appropriately to patient demand in their community. And foundations are meant to be built upon. We can do so much more. And what I'd like to see coming from this body is some recognition of legislative intent to the OHA to convert this foundational language into proactive steps to make sure that patients have continuity of care and that they can access their provider of choice. And some of those steps can be done in the administrative rules process. It can also be done in how the OHA communicates with emerging CCOs. And I've identified four different areas that can be done as we proceed forward. One of them is to simply define provider. It's not defined anywhere in the law. So in administrative rule, the OHA can provide some clarification of what's a provider, what kind of provider should be covered, what kind of provider should be eligible. The second is to make sure that all requests for proposals from the Oregon Health Authority encourage access to all available provider teams. This does not mean that CCOs will be required to contract with every willing provider. Let me be very clear about that. But it does mean that CCOs will have the expectation to make sure that patients have a choice of provider. Further definition of non non-discrimination will be essential. This language is very vague. The federal language isn't actually all that strong, but it can be further clarified. What is discrimination against provider type? What's reasonable versus what's professional prejudice? And lastly, to eliminate a rock-solid conflict dispute resolution process so that people know if there's a problem, what steps can need to be taken, on what timeline, and what remediation courses will there be afterward. So bringing us back to the here and now, your support of Section 8 in this bill or in whatever bill ends up moving as a vehicle for this transformation process, if it ends up not being this bill, will be absolutely critical in laying that foundational support for the future action.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. And the fact that it's 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, I will not belabor the testimony as the chair had requested early, just to say that we support the bill. We support especially Section 8 in the bill, the non-discrimination clause.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Come in. All right. With that, I'd like to call forward Dr. Arisa Bradeen from the Children's Health Alliance, Mary Kay Brady, Women's Healthcare Alliance, and Dr. Sandra Lewis, American College of Cardiology. Please proceed, because we do want to get everyone in.
Okay. Chair Moyne Anderson and members of the committee, I do appreciate you giving me a time to speak with you today. I am Mary Kay Brady with Women's, I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives for Women's Healthcare Associates, and I'm immediate past president of the Oregon Medical Group Management Association. I am here to testify in support of the efforts and accomplishments that the legislature and the Oregon Health Authority have done for healthcare transformation. I also am supportive of the great efforts that are being made across the state. We are very interested in the exciting work we think is being done, accomplished, with Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative. We know and believe that transformation requires a change at the policy and legislative level, CCO organizational levels, and at the operational levels with services and delivery of those services. Women and children are the primary recipients of the services both expected and required by the legislation we're addressing today. Women's Healthcare Associates is a major provider of such services. We support the following four principles. Any local organization, CCO organization, must have physicians from private organizations on the meaningful governance level. Number two, private physician organizations be afforded the opportunity to not only develop effective care models, but to determine quality measures and metrics and finance mechanisms. Number three, legislation enacting CCOs provide the medical liability protection for private physicians or for physicians as anticipated in the language being proposed. Four, there be an opportunity for multiple CCOs in the Portland area. We do not see the inherent strategic need to demand for the demand or need for a single CCO. It is imperative that primary care physicians be involved and engaged in the process of defining the process of providing cost-effective, patient-centered, integrated care. We believe in equitable governing for both public and private systems. We will actively participate in CCOs that involve providers within all levels of the organization, including governance and evaluation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Dr. Risa Bradeen. I'm the medical director of Children's Health Alliance and Children's Health Foundation, as well as a practicing pediatrician at Metropolitan Pediatrics in Portland. Children's Health Alliance is an alliance of 126 primary care pediatricians and 25 sites spread across six counties from Vancouver to Salem and Gresham to Newburgh. Before I start, we need to remember that as of last month, 58% of the Oregon Health Plan enrollees are children. We support the concept of coordinated care organizations and want to see them succeed. A key component to the success of the CCOs is the involvement of the entire delivery system, especially primary care providers. CCOs must make achieving good access one of its highest priorities. This will only occur with provider involvement. Women and children encompass a substantial portion of the Oregon Health Plan population of patients, and the needs of these populations are unique and have the greatest potential for changing the health trajectory in our communities. Although the CCO must focus on improving coordination, lowering costs, and improving outcomes for its sickest members, there must be a significant focus on improving access, prevention, coordination, and early detection of problems for the maternal child populations. A major concern at this point is the failure to adequately consider the needs of these populations due to a majority of the focus being directed to chronically ill adult patients. The pediatricians and obstetricians in our area are committed to serving the needs of the children and pregnant women in our community. Our maternal child health providers have some of the strongest and longest personal bonds with their parents and families. Our providers typically have same-day access, on-call providers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we remain a steadfast, constant, valuable component of this system. We need the tools and support, including accurate information about patients from OHA and CCOs, as well as the opportunity to make effective change. We will actively participate in CCOs that involve providers within all levels of the organization, including governance and evaluation. Change that is executed in a top-down fashion with regulations, policies, and rules, and developed without an understanding of workflows or possible unintended negative consequences and barriers to implementing change will not be successful. Of all the groups that will be involved in CCOs, providers who care for the largest segment of the population, women and children, should be central decision makers in the process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here today. My name is Dr. Sandra Lewis. I'm a cardiologist in Portland, native Oregonian, and I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Cardiology, the adult and pediatric cardiovascular physicians and care associates who believe that physicians need to be involved in CCO leadership from all aspects of medicine. Heart disease remains the leading cause of death for men and women in Oregon. It touches every one of us. If you don't have heart disease, you know someone who has been impacted by heart disease. Cardiovascular medicine has made incredible progress over the last 25 years of my practice. And in fact, in just the last 10 years, we've had a 30% decrease in cardiovascular mortality. Our goal for the Oregon American College of Cardiology chapter is to make Oregon the heart-healthiest state. The Oregon ACC is composed of more than 200 cardiovascular care providers throughout the state. I think it's a good omen that we're meeting in February. February's Heart Month. And I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that today is Wear Red Day, that the American Heart Association, yes, good, thanks, Senator Mayer.
That's as close to red as I can get, okay?
Has this day as a very special day to raise awareness that heart disease is the number one cause of death for women.
That's close enough.
There are several points I'd like to share with you today. First, cardiologists strongly promote the preventive portion of the Oregon Health Authority plans for CCOs. We would like to continue leadership in preventive cardiovascular health for the committee. Come take a walk with a doc. We have a 25-year history of commitment to quality, with registries following our care unparalleled in other specialties in medicine. Under the leadership of your cardiologists, our National Cardiovascular Data Registry, or NCDR, is live in every hospital in Oregon which performs angioplasties and stents. We track on a daily basis our heart care, including every heart attack, defibrillator, or stent performed on your constituents. We serve Medicare, Medicaid, dual eligibles, and patients without coverage, and with our registries, we in Oregon have actually shown national leadership in quality. With the data from our registries and vast amount of clinical research and review, cardiologists have developed guidelines and appropriate use criteria. These guidelines created by our national experts should form the basis for the quality care measurements within the CCOs. We strongly advocate for use of established guidelines and caution leadership to avoid guideline development from individual groups. There's no need for this. It leads our patients to vulnerability from unnecessary and inappropriate care. Oregon cardiologists have a track record from our NCDR registries. With our coronary interventions, that is the balloons and the stents that we put into patients, we meet appropriate use criteria and have lower inappropriate use at a statistically significant level, higher than the national average and even higher than the Pacific states. Finally, we believe that heart patients with important chronic conditions, such as those with congestive heart failure, benefit from their medical home being with a specialist. For instance, this would be a heart failure medical home or neighborhood. I sometimes call it a vacation home type vision within the CCOs. The average patient sees their primary care provider about 1.7 times a year. And within that visit, they need to deal with all preventive care, acute issues, health maintenance, and everything, then the sore throat that they really came there with. This framework just doesn't work for the patient with heart failure who was just discharged from the hospital, is confused, who needs to be seen within a week of discharge, and then every 2 weeks initially to adjust those heart failure medications. They also may need daily calls, home visits, and emergency clinic visits for medication so that they can avoid another hospital visit. If not set up to give that emergency medication at the drop of the hat, the primary care doctor sends that patient to the emergency room. The specialist-directed home must be part of the CCO to avoid unnecessary hospitalizations. Finally, we feel liability reform is crucial, and we propose to look at our guidelines to help establish a framework for malpractice change. For instance, a review of a case by an unbiased panel, which uses our guidelines and finds that they have been followed, even with an unfortunate outcome, should be a method of protecting the practitioner from liability. Cardiology leads other specialties in our guidelines, advanced registries, and appropriate use criteria. We would like to help others develop these resources and believe that it is crucial that physicians are involved in CCO leadership. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. David Schlachtis from the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, Evan Salino, Dr. Evan Salino from the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center.
Chair Monis Anderson, my name is Evan Salino. I'm Vice President of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and I'm here today representing our 1,400 family doctors across the state who care for thousands of Oregonians of all ages. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 1580. I want to start by painting a picture of why I and so many other family doctors in Oregon care about these issues. Mr. C has been a patient of mine for a number of years. He lives in Washington County and is on the Oregon Health Plan. Actually, he's dual eligible because he's disabled. He's paraplegic and in a wheelchair. And a few years ago, he needed a new shower chair. His old one had a crack in it, and so it was dangerous to use. However, the request for a new one was denied by his managed care organization because their focus was to save money in the short term. And according to their checklist, he didn't qualify for the new $57 shower chair. While we were unsuccessfully appealing this decision, Mr. C was cut by the broken shower chair seat. He didn't feel the infection setting in because he doesn't have feeling in his legs. Next thing we knew, Mr. C was in the hospital with Fournier's gangrene, which is an extensive life-threatening bacterial infection that spreads from the skin into internal tissues. Mr. C nearly died. He needed extensive surgery to remove the dead tissue. He ended up with a colostomy. He had multiple skin graft surgeries to repair the damage, and he was in bed recovering for nearly 2 years. The total cost to the state of Oregon for his care directly related to the $57 shower seat denial was well over $2 million. Mr. C suffered these unfortunate events because the system was not focused on the needs that he and those closest to him identified. It's this focus that we're here to discuss changing today. I'm really pleased to see us at this point in the reform conversation. We're so much further than we were a few years ago. We at the Academy agree that the concept of community care organizations should move forward into the implementation phase. We recognize that there's a tightrope to walk between being flexible and setting up the ground rules and yet assuring that Oregonians get the high-quality, patient-centered care we all agree is our goal. But we must design an inclusive structure of leadership with oversight focused on what is best for patients, with emphasis on care integration and coordination occurring as close to the patient as possible. For example, in well-supported primary care homes. The CCO structures cannot simply rely on renaming old systems or shifting money into different buckets so it's distributed by the same people in the same ways. We need new systems of patient care and coordination, and alignment of incentives and investment in patient-centered primary care homes across the state. These will be keys to successful implementation of the CCO concept on the ground. So Mr. C, he's just recovering now from the last of his surgeries. He had it a few days ago to fix a hernia of his colostomy. My home clinic is transforming into a primary care home model of care with behavioral health on site and giving people like Mr. C the best quality patient-centered care we can afford. So the care he's receiving is better than it was before. But we're struggling mightily to make this patient-centered model sustainable because incentives and oversight are too often aligned against the care delivery models that provide comprehensive care and coordination as close to the patient as possible. As Mr. C likes to say, I'm living proof that prevention and care coordination save money. When CCOs are implemented, for Mr. C's sake and the sake of all Oregonians, let's innovate in ways that makes care better, not just different. By focusing down on communities and clinical teams that know patients, and by transforming in ways that we know are good for patients to keep them healthy, that's how we're going to save money and provide the best care and the best value for Oregonians over time. We believe that Senate Bill 1580 creates a framework for transforming and can move us forward. But there's a lot of work that still needs to be done as CCOs are developed and implemented, and that changes are needed at the local level. But Senate Bill 1580 is a good start. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Willamette Surgery Center and Hope Orthopedics of Oregon, both here in Salem. Today I'm here representing the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association and private practice independent physicians. I'll keep my comments brief as I know the day is winding down. Our concern is twofold. One has to do with participation and the other with reimbursement rates. You've heard a lot of testimony today about the management structures that will govern the CCOs. One of the things that we also need to be cognizant of is who will be participating in the CCOs and who will potentially not be allowed to participate in the CCOs. The reality is that in various parts of the state, depending on who gets the application for the CCO, they will have the ability to make decisions on participation based on what they feel is in their political best interest. And I know we've tried to stay away from that. I know we've tried to say, okay, they're going to get everyone from their community together and they're all going to work together happily to make this happen. But there are various parts of the state where hospitals, if they are given the right to be the CCO, have a financial best interest in making sure that surgery centers are not necessarily allowed to participate. We know that statistically surgery centers provide an incredibly high level of quality care to our patients in this state, and we know that they provide it at a lower cost than hospitals. So as a result, we think it's really important that there be some type of prescriptive language that basically says that a CCO therefore must require non-discrimination of facilities based on their ability to qualify if they can say that they are a certified facility. So, for instance, our facility is Joint Commission certified, the same as every hospital in the state. Most of the other ASCs in the state are also certified either through what is called AAAHC, which is a certification body, or Joint Commission. The same thing can be said of primary care physicians and specialists. Again, if you award a contract to a hospital system that also employs their own physicians, frankly, it's in their own financial best interest to include only their physicians and not include other physicians in the community. That way, they'll have all of the resources and be able to deal with those resources internally. We don't think that's in the best interest of the CCOs and the best interest of the patients of our state. And so we encourage you to have some type of language in there that prescribes that those people do need to be included. The second thing is reimbursement. So if we have a system that says, okay, we need to allow these people that are high-quality, low-cost providers to participate, there's nothing in there that says that they can't participate, but we'll pay you 5 cents on the dollar. And so, again, we would urge you to think long and hard about putting in some type of language that creates a floor that says, yes, they need to participate, we'll allow you to participate, and we have to pay you some type of reimbursement that everyone agrees is a fair reimbursement rate. I know you've got a lot on your plate. I know that there's a lot to think about, but we would also ask you to include this as you move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center's mission is to work on access to justice for low-income people, and that's why we've been involved in this healthcare discussion all along. Obviously, the first population that we're talking about in transformation is the Medicaid population. But as we step back and look at this, I just have to say that I'm proud of the work being done in Oregon, because I think we really got it right on issues like the triple aim, the values of a person-centered approach, integrated services, and health equity. And I can't help but notice that Senator Gordley is in the audience today, and so often she would remind us of the need of looking at equity for populations. And I think all throughout the language, through the discussion in the plan itself, I think we can be proud of the progress that we've made in committing to eliminating health disparities. The legislature was really very insightful about thinking about how to involve the community at large, how to involve key stakeholders right from the beginning, going back to the 2007 session, and then through House Bill 2009, creating the Oregon Health Policy Board. And I have to say that I've had many opportunities to testify and to be involved with the Health Policy Board, as well as to work with staff, and I want to commend them, the Health Policy Board and the staff, in being open and accessible. We didn't get everything that we wanted. Frankly, we're nervous about a number of the issues that come with implementation, but today I'm here to encourage you to move forward, and we look forward to that implementation when we'll have further involvement and discussion with the community, and indeed in also involving the consumers in this big change that we're embarking on. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. And our final panel, Kelsey Wilson of the Oregon Business Association, Betsy Earls from AOI, and Andy Easton from the Hospital Association. Andy, go ahead.
Ramona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, the Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I know the hour is late, so I'll keep my comments very brief. On behalf of all of our hospitals, we support transformation and we support it going forward. I think the testament that you've heard today, the work that's going on in the Tri-County areas, as well as what's happening in Douglas County, and among the other areas around the state, various levels of conversations are taking place. I think that's a true testament to our commitment to moving forward with transformation. That being said, we do have a few concerns, many of which have already been addressed, so I will speak very highly to them. Senator Bates had mentioned that the fast track will be removed. We do appreciate that conversation and having that. We do think the strengthening around antitrust language needs to be put into a bill so that we can continue to have the conversations that we are having right now at the various levels around the state. We also think that a key piece of this needs to be around governance, and there will be lots of conversation around what the governance structure will look like. But one of the issues for us is that how is the entity that's at the most financial risk being defined? Will it be the managing CCO versus the providers who are accepting the risk for Medicaid patients? And then finally, liability. Meaningful transformation of healthcare would be remiss if we didn't have something around liability reform. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Kelsey Wilson with Gallatin Public Affairs, representing the Oregon Business Association. During the 2009 session, OBA supported House Bill 3650, and we continue to be very supportive of transformation and Senate Bill 1580. During the interim, OBA's Health Policy Committee formed a subcommittee to closely monitor both the development of the exchange and the transformation implementation plan. Our subcommittee formed OBA guiding principles that we feel should be employed to measure the success of transformation and help define a coordinated care organization structure, power, and function, and I've distributed those for your review. As you're all well aware, healthcare costs are increasingly unaffordable to businesses, individuals, the state, and federal government, and OBA sees transformation as an opportunity for future economic sustainability and investment that will not only lead to improved healthcare, and lower costs, but could allow current funding that currently goes towards health care to be reinvested in education, public safety, and economic growth programs. The current fiscal climate creates an opportunity to redesign Oregon's healthcare delivery system and get better value for all. OBA is optimistic that transformation will increase the number of covered lives and reverse the growing trend of cost shift to business and the private sector, and we look forward to working together with you and the other stakeholders as implementation continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelsey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI has been and continues to be very supportive of both health insurance reform through the exchange and health payment reform through the health system transformation bill that we've been working on. Obviously, Oregon is in an unsustainable situation as far as health care costs go, and we need to change the health system to reduce the cost to the extent that we are able. We believe that coordination of care has great potential if done well to help control those costs, if done well and properly funded. We have some concerns. We're supportive of moving the bill as it is. However, we'd like to make sure that during the session we address the fact that because Medicaid will be the initial focus of the CCOs, it's really critical to us that the global budget that's developed to pay for health care services for this population is actuarially sound. Given Oregon's current economic circumstances, I think it would be very tempting to underprice or underfund the services that are provided by CCOs. And AOI believes that if sound funding of the CCOs doesn't occur, it would have negative consequences for reform all across the board. Medicaid beneficiaries and the business community and others that purchase private insurance could run across difficulties, I think, in a number of ways. Absent an honest appraisal of the funding necessary for CCOs to carry out their work, CCOs could be reluctant to make the capital investment to form. They require actuarially sound funding from the state to build the successful model that they need to. Also, unsound financing could deter other groups from joining the Medicaid population in that CCO. As they face the prospect of subsidizing the underfunded Medicaid population, OEBPEB or other prospective clients of the CCO may find this a deterrent to joining those organizations. Business and other private purchasers of healthcare services obviously pay a premium associated with the cost shift due to underfunding of those populations. So it's essential to us, to our members and purchasers, that in reforming the system, we don't sort of reinvent the cost shift within the CCO by, I hate to say arbitrary, but underfunding of the Medicaid and CCO care that we provide. Something like that would probably prompt purchasers to move away from employer-sponsored coverage and allow their employees to purchase coverage through the exchange. Right? And that's
Thank
all
you
I have for today.
Very much. Any comments? Yes, Senator Bay.
A quick comment. Andy, antitrust language, could you propose some for us and bring it to us early next week?
We'd be happy to.
I haven't heard that issue really brought to a high level yet, and that might be a very important point. So we'd like to see some language about that.
We will do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1580 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1580. And colleagues, the reason I'm opening a work session is we've heard a number of issues regarding governance, risk, antitrust, experience, global budgeting, advisory committees, innovation agents, defensive medicine costs, fair governance standards, payment and arbitration issues, metrics in a transparent process. And we need to have a bill down in Ways and Means, because we are, if we don't have a bill, a transformation bill down in Ways and Means, it's going to be a, we will be a quarter of $1 billion out of balance. House bill, or we've had a great public process for this particular bill, Senate Bill 1580. Section 13 required OHA, the health authority, to conduct a meaningful public process to develop recommendations. It used the policy board. It's a 9-member policy public oversight board. It had more than 1,200 Oregonians providing input through 8 community meetings that were held around the state and through online surveys. There was Portland, Medford, Astoria, Bend, Roseburg, Eugene, Florence, and Pendleton. And then there were another 133 people met in 4 targeted work groups from August through November to provide input and recommendations on CCO metrics, global budget criteria, and how to include people eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid in CCOs. So every month since the passage of House Bill 3650, there's been a public Oregon Health Policy Board meeting on transformation and a public comment period. 2 meetings were held in January 10th and the 24th. And the 2 public comment periods were held on drafts of the CCO proposal, December 13th through January 2nd, January 10th through January 18th, and there were more than 600 comments that were received by the board during the comment periods. And legislative concept has been publicly vetted since November through the monthly Oregon Health Policy Board meetings and at a legislative committees during December and January. So the legislative committee hearings on transformation were held in September, November, December, and January. So yes, you may feel that this is fast track, but we do have these other concerns that some of you have. So we do have another bill. It is Senate Bill 1509 that has a huge relating clause, health care. And I want everyone who has these concerns to ask for notes from Mother to get these concepts to Legislative Council. We'd like to have them in. We don't know what kind of a burden this would put on Legislative Council, but we know that some of these issues will be held in Ways and Means. We know it. But the more we can have as a public process, a public hearing process, I think the better it will. We always hate to have Ways and Means be making policy decisions without a public process. So that is my views on this issue and discussion, colleagues. Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, would it be your preference to make a motion and then have discussion after that? Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1580 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Shields moves that Senate Bill 1580 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
I will.
Discussion.
He was in the queue.
Who?
Okay, well then, I would be happy to speak. Listening to all that you said, Madam Chair, in all due respect, there was a very public process, and at the end of that public process, some folks went into a little dark room somewhere and started writing a bill. Okay? And you say that we had access to, what we had access to was concepts. It was just in the last couple weeks that we actually saw any LC language of anything. And from the perspective of the Legislative Assembly, until we see something in bill form, we really don't know what is there other than just concepts. I would suggest, quite honestly, that when I came into this building, policy issues were not dealt with in Ways and Means. It was a violation of the way this process is supposed to work. But what I've seen over the last few sessions is more and more of that is happening. And quite honestly, and it's going to happen with this one, I fully understand that. But I don't think that gives people the appropriate level of opportunity to weigh in on the issues. And you say that time is short. That is absolutely true. We are the third day of the session and we're sending this bill to Ways and Means. Third day of the session, knowing full well that this bill is going to be reworked in some very, very major ways. And to say we are going to do another bill, I seriously doubt that that's going to happen. Once this bill gets through, everything else will probably fall away, and we know that too. I am supportive of moving ahead with this. And there's some things we could do, and those of us on this committee have been fully engaged up until right now. And then, in all due respect, Senator Bates is on that subcommittee, and he will be fully engaged, and I will hopefully be able to have input into it. But it's not like it was being done in this committee, which is where it should be done, where we all are truly engaged. This is the Health Care Committee. We are supposed to do health care policy. The Ways and Means Committee is supposed to do budget. That is the way this system was set up. And we should honor the way this system is supposed to work. And to say that day three of the session, we no longer have time, in my mind, is totally absurd. We do have time to do this. And I told you yesterday I was strenuously objecting to this parliamentary move we are making because now, this bill goes to, they say it's the basement, but really the Ways and Means Committee, it's on the same floor. I don't know why they always say it's the basement because it's truly not. I'm not saying anything disrespectful to any of the members of that subcommittee. They're all friends of mine. We all work together. What I'm talking about is the way the legislative process is supposed to work and the violation of the way that process is meant to work. And this is a huge example of that. And I wish that we could take another week and we could probably do all the things necessary with this bill and then send the Ways and Means Committee a finished product rather than just basically a blank slate, which is what we're doing. So, in all due respect to you, Madam Chair, we've worked together for a long time. I think you're absolutely wrong, and this is absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not belabor the point. I think Senator Cruz has stated it very well. There's a very serious problem. Whenever we encounter this difficult legislation, in the last session and now in this short session, the policy committees do not do the work. Wind up sending it down to Ways and Means. It calls into question of why we have a policy committee. And I think that's a very serious issue. And not that I don't trust and respect, certainly, Dr. Bates leading this effort in Ways and Means, I question why we have a policy committee if we don't do policy in a policy committee. For that reason, I will not support the motion.
I would like to respond to the fact that we are passing good policy in Senate Bill 1580. It is good policy. So far, no one has objected at all to anything that we are sending down to Ways and Means right now. It's what isn't in Senate Bill 1580. And because there are so many different proposed amendments to 1580, we will be discussing those as amendments, and they can be submitted to Senate Bill 1509. And we will be discussing those amendments, and they will be sent down to Ways and Means. You have to realize also the House has two other bills, two or three, I'm not sure how many. They are coming up with things that they will want in the bill also. And so because it goes down to Ways and Means, they will pick and choose. So I still think that all of these amendments are going to be vetted to the extent possible that we can, because on Monday, that's 3 days from now, I have to have the bills posted for public hearing and work session. Then the follow, and then we will have three more meetings and we are out of here. It's extremely important to have a clean bill down in Ways and Means we will be out of balance by $250 million if we don't get a clean bill down there. We still have the opportunity in this committee to vet a number of amendments that are going to be put forward. Yeah, Senator Bates.
I want to cut Senator Cruz off.
Everybody gets their turn.
Okay. Well, first I'll say, one of my favorite foods still is bratwurst and sausage. But I don't want to watch how they make it, okay? So I understand that. We need to get this bill to a joint committee as quickly as possible. The joint committee we're going to use is Ways and Means. We have a very short timeline of about 2 weeks here to get this bill finished and out and onto the floors. I don't believe we can do it through two policy committees in this short a time. Each one of the amendments we will be looking at has potential fiscal to it. We're going to have to look at those from the point of view of fiscal as well as policy. I'm not going to lie about that. We'll be looking at policy and financial aspects of each one of those amendments. But we've got to get to that committee quickly. Behind all this is potentially $500 million a year for the next 5 years. And we've got about 2 weeks to get this out and across both floors. If we don't do that, total funds, we're going to be short in the second half of this biennium, and the Oregon Health Plan is $750 million. $750 million we'll be short. And we need that money for transformation. We need to get some small savings probably in that first year, and more to be expected third, fourth, and fifth year out. We need to move this. We need to move it now. And it's not the cleanest process. If we had 6 months right now, I would say let's hold it here and work on it more. We don't have 6 months. We really have about 2 weeks, and it's a push even at 2 weeks. We have things coming from the House that have to be also considered, and those are going to come through to us and have to be considered also. I want to tell the people on this committee that ideas, thoughts, and amendments that you present here will be brought down and seriously and absolutely seriously considered at the level of the Joint Committee. And it's a Joint Committee issue that I'm trying to force through here. It's not that it's Ways and Means. It's a Joint Committee of House and Senate members in one place to have this discussion. And we fully expect and hope for you to continue to participate in that. I understand, and I expect some no votes today, and I understand why, and I respect those no votes.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was interesting. Senator Whitsitt in full Ways and Means today made a comment on doing policy in the Ways and Means Committee, and the Senate co-chair, Senator Devlin, said, we don't do that. And obviously, he hadn't read the notice, because here is exactly what we are doing. I would also suggest, if you look back at the beginning of last session, the bills related to transformation that the governor put forward basically said, we aren't sure what we want to do, but we want you to give us the authority to do it. And we rejected that, and which is why we came up with Senate House Bill 3650 to put some touch points in. As I read Section 1 of the bill we are just passing, it basically says, give us the authority to do whatever we want. You know, and so if you think that is a good way to do public policy, is turning over all authority to the executive branch, then you will like this bill. And when you say we can do another bill, my fear is, once they've got that, why would they want to do anything else? The bill that we're sending will be the vehicle at the end of the day. For whatever restrictions we put on the process, and we should put some. I just wish we were doing it in this committee. And something of this importance, if it was going to take us a couple extra days, I think we would have that.
This bill, Senate Bill 1580, I think is a major step in health care reform, and it is going to make a difference. And it's going to help our most vulnerable. And it's going to help the middle class, believe it or not, because we have a lot of people, thousands of people who have lost their jobs, and that means they've lost their health benefits. And so it's really crucial to keep some of these people from falling through the cracks. And I think this particular bill is going to offer us a better and smarter, efficient approach to health care, and it is going to save taxpayers millions of dollars, and it is going to improve care. It's focusing on prevention and chronic disease management, and it's going to be less costly and less ER visits. So this is significant, I think. I know it is significant to balance our budget, and it is going to allow us to prioritize resources to better protect what I think matters to most of us. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as we move towards a vote on this, I wanted to declare a potential conflict of interest. My wife is a primary care provider.
I suppose I should declare the same thing. I'm a primary care provider. I have a large number of Medicaid patients in my practice and a huge number of dual eligibles.
And your wife works there, too. So.
And my wife works there, and my daughter works there.
My friend works there.
Is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Yes.
Senator Morris.
No.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
No.
Chair Juan Sanderson.
Aye. Motion carries. And with that, it's off to Ways and Means. Okay, we are adjourned.
Don't go. No, we got to go. Well.